Woohoo! Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are doing two episodes this week, so we're stepping up. And in one more piece of housekeeping news, Megan was right.
We're going to three topics.
Yeah, we're going to three topics. So,
I just would like to say for the record, I call this on episode one,
yeah.
and it only took us six episodes to get here. We're on episode seven now,
I
so.
think this is probably a good metaphor for our relationship, actually. So yeah, if this is the first one you've listened to, I pushed really hard to do five topics and do them quick hitters. And then Megan was like, no. And over time, the listeners chimed in and sided with Megan in overwhelming numbers. Probably more people saying that than anything else to our email line.
It was really fun. It was like sitting in class, you know, when they do those live class polls and you could see the numbers rising over time, and it was getting giddy joy out of this fact of seeing the votes for three just continue to trickle in.
Oh my
So
God, I felt like
thank you for that, listeners.
I felt like Gary Johnson with my 1% vote total. So yeah, someworkallplay@gmail.com. We're listening to your suggestions, at least when it comes to the number of topics we're doing. And in more exciting news, we have a new logo from the world famous designer Abbey Levine. So if you click on the podcast now, you'll see the T-Rex with the podcast name, which is really good because before the logo just said SWAP, SWAP. And we also heard from listeners that if you search in the podcast players SWAP or variations of that, you get some very different podcast titles.
Some very interesting things.
Yeah. Apparently, we should both be very careful about calling our athletes swappers. So yeah. Okay. And yeah, Megan, what are you going to say for the intro today?
Oh man, today's been a busy work day.
Yeah.
It's been a great work day though, so I'll take it. I've been converting most of my research studies from in-person studies to remote studies, and that comes with a lot of logistical nightmares, as many things in science do once you
Yeah.
start changing directions. And yesterday I just had this heck with it moment and emailed a bunch of people and said, hey, I need some help figuring this out. And so today I made some strides with actually talking to people on the phone and asking questions and walking through everything. And I feel like this weight is lifted off my
Well, so
chest because I actually know what's going
to
on.
give everyone a taste of what it's like, all of a sudden I just look over and Megan's just like dancing. She's stir doing this.
Just doing some grooving.
She's stirring the pot. She's basically doing the worm while sitting up. It's very impressive. And I'm like, what's going on? And she's like, I asked for help and it worked out.
It worked out really well. Well, I'm just the type of person that will sit there stubbornly, and whether it's with computer code or with databases or anything like that, I'll just not read the instructions and just try everything and see what
Have you
happens.
always been like that, or is
I've
that?
always been like that with
Yeah.
cooking, with putting things together. Like it's kind of a miracle that some of our kitchen furniture and our beds haven't just
Actually,
exploded, because I just like hammer things and I'm like, yeah, this'll work.
that we did build a bookcase in California, if you remember.
Oh, it was like the Leaning Tower of
Yeah,
Pisa
and
by
then
the end of
eventually
it.
it all just fell right at the end, right before we left, thankfully. So it did last a year, which is pretty substantial, but.
Well, the great thing about science is I'm learning that you can't create Leaning Towers of
Yeah.
Pisa in science because your entire work will be messed up. So I am learning to be organized, learning to ask for help, learning to read the directions. And I'll say this, it's kind of revolutionary.
Yeah.
I wish I learned this a little sooner. My cooking and baking skills might be
Well, I
better.
think, it's even less about learning. I think for you, it's about, you're not admit like by asking for help at some level, you're admitting you need help,
That's true.
and that's hard, I think, especially for like women to do sometimes because you've had to work so hard to get where you are. Nothing's been given to you. So like, what happens when you ask for help?
Well, the thing about it is it's not so much me feeling weird about
Yeah.
asking for help. I mean, I don't mind. I'm like, I don't know anything. This is okay. I'll ask for help. It's that I don't want to inconvenience other
Yeah.
people. So I don't want to be like, oh, hey, can you talk to me on the phone today because I need help, thinking about just how many phone calls that person has or them having to answer my questions because I didn't necessarily read the
Yeah.
instructions. And so I think that's more the element of it. And
Yeah.
I've learned over time that as long as you're gracious about it and honest with people, they're usually pretty helpful.
I love that. Mine comes from a little bit different place, from like that ego male place in some ways, especially when it comes to baking, which I have officially retired from. Because when Megan and I first started dating, I was like, I'm really gonna impress her and bake a cheesecake. But I didn't look at a recipe, which is the ultimate example of not asking for help.
You were so excited about the creative
I was,
process, though. You're like, look at this cheesecake. I'm figuring it out on
I'm
my
gonna
own.
crush this. And what turned out was this like crumbly, horrific graham cracker covered in just straight cream cheese. honestly, it was one of the most disgusting. We like all food, as we've discussed before. And I am very lucky you didn't break up with me
then. I still ate it, though. My approach to this cheesecake was I just took a toasted bagel and just swiped it off the top and was like, well, I've got my cream cheese right here in one place.
I think if I remember correctly, I might have even put like chocolate whey protein in the batter.
You did. It was gross. Oh my God,
it was so bad. You ate it, though, which I think is probably the best example of love I have ever heard. So speaking of love and related topics, we're going to get to topic one, which for the first time ever, I am not going to introduce today because you'll see why in a second.
I love this topic. So thank you everyone for sending in questions, sending in vulnerable questions, sending in funny questions, all of the above. We're just grateful for that. So this question comes from B, and she says, in high school, I struggled with eating. It may or may not be related, but I've also had thoughts about small breast size. Can you talk about boobs?
We'll stop there for a second. That's the best question that has ever existed.
Seriously, the best question. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, B.
And we were reviewing for this podcast, and I was like, well, it's episode 7 of the podcast, and we're already talking about boobs, so this is great.
Yeah, imagine
we're progressing
Imagine we'll be in 14. We're just going to be going straight for it.
Yeah, so this definitely parallels my experience. I think I thought about this a lot in high school and college as well. I remember thinking about like all the different things I could do to increase breast size. I thought about stomach sleeping. I was like, oh my gosh, maybe sleeping on my stomach is limiting my breast growth. And so if you think about it, physics, compression, like, so in high school.
You're like a bonsai tree, which just like constrains your growth.
Yeah, that was my great thought process.
Oh no, I get it, trust me.
Channeling the powers of all my physics learning. And so even though I'm a natural stomach sleeper in high school, I went through this period for a few years where I was like, I'm going to sleep on my back. I'm going to see what happens.
Just let the sun come in, photosynthesize.
Exactly. Let's start photosynthesizing these boobs. And it did not work out very well. Other things I tried, push-ups. I was like, well, maybe we're just going to like stimulate some muscle growth.
Is the theory there that the pecs will make up for it?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
It didn't really work either, but it made me great at field hockey, I think.
Yeah.
So we'll
ulterior
take it.
Benefits.
Yeah, yeah, ulterior benefits from that. I also tried positive self-talk. Like,
Sorry. So what does positive self-talk look with your boobs?
I was like, maybe if I tell them they're great, they'll grow. It's like unconditional support. It's you have the gift to not grow, but maybe you will. And so I was like, by giving them the chance just to know they're loved as they are, maybe something will happen that didn't work either.
It didn't work.
Then I gave up on positive self-talk and was like, well, I'm just going to have to.
Did you try any negative reinforcement?
I did not.
Grow, you boobs.
I did not try that.
No.
But then I think eventually, so this bothered me through high school, bothered me like in the early days of college, especially like, I think those are vulnerable times
for
young girls.
For
like, you're thinking about body image, you're thinking about all these different things. Plus like you're in locker rooms and you're like, oh my gosh, what's wrong with me?
Yeah.
Like, is there something actually wrong with me? And somewhere around the time of sophomore year in college, I just kind of came to the realization, I think most of my concerns stemmed around relationships. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh my gosh, is someone going to love me because I have like the smallest chest size? And I came to the conclusion that someone was going to have to love me for my boob jokes, for my personality, for everything else. And that it created a great filter on who I was actually going to date.
Oh my gosh. Like a Tinder filter?
It's like a Tinder filter. Yeah. People were going to have to swipe on my personality and not my boobs.
Oh, or maybe they would love your boobs the way they are, which is like the best of all worlds,
right? Well, thank you. Yeah, that would be the best of all worlds.
So but I met you right after that.
Yeah, and you passed the filter, so congratulations.
Well, yeah, I mean, you're perfect the way you are.
Well, thank you.
But you have no control over that, right? Like, I mean, why? It's so crazy to judge yourself or have other, you know, society judge you over something that's just totally random for the most part. I mean, it's like nothing that you choose. Like, there's no amount of bonsai tree or positive self-talk you can do.
Yeah, and I think I really just embraced that element that I had no control over this. I mean, I did literally did everything I could to try to increase my breast size and nothing happened.
You told me about their studies and stuff on like the genetics of it too. And
that's the other thing too, is that breast size is actually highly heritable. So there's a great study from 2012. It's a GWAS study, which is a genome-wide association study. And they looked at self-reported bra size in 16,000 European women.
Whoa.
And, correlated that to genetics. And they actually found that there were some, it's decently heritable. A former twin study found that 56% of heritability in breast size occurs from genetics.
So in other words, like, yeah, it's something that's just kind of out of, it's not like a decision about what you did in high school necessarily or anything like this. It's about something that you're either born with or it's a mix of that and environment and other things that are just like random. And like when Megan was talking about this and we're talking about doing this, I think the idea is to broaden it out into body image more generally. Like for me, for example, you know, I have all these pictures of when I was a kid, and many of them were at the pool. And I was the fat kid at the pool that wore a shirt, right? And so I'm sitting there doing the world's saddest wet t-shirt contest around all my friends. And, you know, clearly so up in my own head. And looking back, it's like clearly no one there cared, right? Like it was just me that cared. And I felt so much like, oh, I'm never going to have a girlfriend or whatever. And then even later on, after I lost most of that weight, like I would still be so self-conscious. I just found new things to be self-conscious about.
And I think that's the thing, is everyone is self-conscious about something, about their body, about themselves, about anything. And it's like just having empathy for other people and saying it's okay. Like we all feel that way. And that's, I mean, it's natural.
Well, and it's so weird because, I mean, the way our skin holds in our insides is so, like, it's not necessarily that important. It's like society and culture and our own self-image and magazine covers and all these things combine to create this ideal of like the human body that is totally irrelevant. Like it doesn't have anything to do with its functionality or your health or anything like that.
But what I like thinking about on this topic is the concept of being unique. So I think we've talked about that a lot. And it's like, for me, I think being unique is beauty.
Yeah.
And being comfortable in your uniqueness is an even deeper sense of beauty. And I like that. Plus it gives you good stories to tell. Like if I didn't have small boobs, we wouldn't be sitting here telling jokes about this on the podcast.
No, it's so cool. And I was thinking of another story to try to, you know, meet Megan with her vulnerability in high school. So you know how they have all those movies like 40-Year-Old Virgin and things like that, where, you know, the sexually inexperienced man in the story, like the punchline is that like when they have sex, they can't perform or whatever. So in my extreme self-consciousness of being in high school, I would read all these articles in like Men's Health and then all that other things. And so as a 16-year-old that was not sexually active whatsoever, I was doing like Kegel exercises. I was probably the strongest Kegel exerciser at 16 of anyone because I saw these movies and was so self-conscious about a hypothetical that wasn't going to happen for a while.
You're putting out Kegel watts.
Oh my God, I was. If you had a power meter on whatever that would be considered, you could do the anatomy
this
there.
This is the first time that we've had this discussion. I'm glad, I'm glad it's on live recording.
Exactly. So yeah, I mean, basically the message here is that like, let's all try to internalize less of the things we don't have control over. You know, someone will love you as you are and that matters. But what matters most of all is loving yourself as you are. And like, you know,
actually, I would argue this. I think that in order for someone to love you as you are, you have to love yourself as you are. So I think it just becomes an even more important element to all of this.
Yeah. And, you know, we're all going to find reasons to self-criticize, especially about our bodies. Like, you know, if you're looking in the mirror and like, first, what you see might not be what's actually there. But even if it is, like, there's no way to meet a platonic ideal of this impossibility. Right.
Well, I think the platonic ideal of that impossibility also might not be there.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you think about society, like there are, you know, breast implants, there are, you know, plastic surgeries, there are all of these things. And it's like, that might not even be real.
Yeah. And
like, you may be holding yourself to unreal standards.
And we're talking about breast size. Like, you know, the woman with the small boobs might in high school might think, oh, but, you know, the high school boys want, you know, whatever, want something different. But then, you know, maybe at 30, it changes, you know, for society and culture and things. So, you know, it's this shell game where, you know, or like whack-a-mole is probably the better way to say it. Like a mole comes up, you hit it, and then it comes up somewhere else. Like it's going to be this shifting and rotating thing. And getting comfortable with that is tough. And so
this builds on the uncertainty conversation that we had earlier on. Yeah. It's like, you just got to accept that this discomfort will likely be there. And that's part of the self-love, is embracing
it. And it's super relevant for running too, because a lot of the times we are, especially in summer, minimally clothed, right?
That's true. And a lot of we should do an entire topic on that actually, because I've seen a lot of runners struggle with that.
Yeah.
And it's so freeing to run in whatever clothing you want, whether that's a sports bra or a men's shirtless or whatever. And I think like embracing your body as is and just feeling powerful in that goes a long way in the summer heat.
Yeah. And it's like, to get to the point of how much people will all find something. You know, there's some pro athletes on the team that do photo shoots and like sports bras and things for their sponsors. And, you know, I don't think they're getting critical comments, but I will often, you know, we'll often hear, super hyper self-critical comments because they have to be presented in this way. And they're starting to think of themselves as like, how am I going to look in pictures and all these different things. And basically, you know, chasing an impossibility, even for someone that is in the photo shoots, it just goes down these rabbit holes of self-judgment that are never going to be healthy. So yeah, our big takeaway on this is you're beautiful the way you are. And like that,
and love yourself the way you are.
Yeah. And that's really hard. And it's not a question of I choose to love myself tomorrow. It's a question of being just a little bit more okay with yourself every single day that you possibly can. And over time, you might look back, you know, like I do with those little kid pictures and be like, man, I just wish that kid would take off his shirt and be okay with, you know, that big stomach, because that whole all goes into what makes him him. And just as that little kid is, like, he's good. He's fine. And same goes for, I wish I could, you know, like, I wish we were both in high school together.
That would be fun.
Yeah.
For many reasons outside of this discussion.
It would have been amazing. Okay. Onward from that topic. I actually think that went a little better than I was fearing that I would step in some hot water there.
You did great. I'm proud of you.
Thank you. So see, these affirmations like just kick me up a notch. So topic two is on dealing with injuries from listener MC. So, you know, I think the place to start here is that injury is absolutely inevitable. There's a number of studies on it, but basically severe injuries for serious runners about 50% of the time, you know, one out of every 2 years across the population. So if you think of it as a coin flip and you flip coins for 10 years, that means that it's way less than 1% chance that you ever avoid injury, you know, for a 10-year period of time. So, you know, one, it's inevitable. And two, injury is directly tied to adaptation, right? Like the, you know, if you're training for performance and adaptation, you have to push your body to a point where it bends. Hopefully it doesn't break, but the idea of bending is sometimes you don't know where that breaking point is. So have the courage to go for it. And when you deal with injuries, like, it's not your fault.
And removing the element of, you know, mistakes with injury, I think it's something that's valuable, because oftentimes, like, if you're going for it enough, like you said, it's just, it's rolling the dice. Like you're going to have this. And I see so many athletes who internalize that and say like, oh, this is my fault. These are the should-haves, the could-haves. And it's like, no, this is something that probably was going to happen. And now the focus should be on using this time period to build back strength, to build back, to come back stronger and to really rebuild that foundation, so it doesn't happen again.
Yeah. I mean, like when LeBron James hurt his knee last year, no one's like, LeBron, man, what's your freaking problem? You know, it's no, LeBron is LeBron, you know, and when, as runners, we're all pushing to be our like individual version of that, like the best athletic version, right? Like,
what I think about that too, is that the body is just an incredibly complex machine. Mm-hmm. So LeBron hurting his knee could have come from the fact that he slept weird the night before and his back was in a weird position, which caused him to hurt his knee. And it's like, the thing about injuries is we often don't know the causal reason behind injuries. And I bet in many situations, it's weirder than you think.
Yeah. And
it's
more
some
complex.
Weird abnormality going on the surface that you cannot control.
Or a genetic variable that pre-existed. Like this athlete had it when they were born, and there's no way to grow out of that genetic variable, right?
There's an entire field. Actually, I do some research in this related to genetic predictors of sports injury.
Yeah.
And certain people may just be vulnerable to things.
Yeah. I mean, you had an experience with injury last year that was like, has taught me so much as a coach and everything else. Like, you know, so what happened? Like, I think a lot of people probably don't have any backstory of that.
So probably, I guess it was a year and 3 months ago now. It's funny how I, for so long, I knew the exact time period back to when this happened.
Number of days, exactly.
The number of days, number of hours, number of seconds. But I was running here in Boulder and I had been dealing with high hamstring pain.
Which is normal for runners, right? Like, I mean, a lot of runners deal with chronic high hamstring issues, but not...
The high hamstring pain that I had been dealing with, though, was impacting my power and form. So I got to the point where I was really struggling to put that power on runs. But so I was running here in Boulder a year ago in 2 months, and I stepped in a gopher hole with my right hamstring that was a little bit abnormal at baseline, and I ruptured the entire high hamstring.
Oh.
It was rough. And
yeah, it takes my breath away just thinking back, because I remember that phone call where you said it. And like, Megan has such good body awareness that, you know, when you said that, I was like, oh crap, that's it.
I remember calling you, and this was seconds after it happened.
Yeah.
And the first thing I said was, David, I just ruptured my entire high
hamstring. Like,
I knew it immediately. And it's funny, it didn't even hurt that bad, but it was, for whatever reason, it was like that athlete's intuition where I was like, this is gone. I know it. And it was scary. But then even though I called you and said that, like 5 minutes later, I called back and was like, actually, I think I'm good. I'm going to try to run.
Yeah, you're going to run back. And I was like, Megan, you've always been right about this in your life. just walk home this one time.
I actually walk jogged, but I did get back. Yeah.
Well, I guess it didn't really matter at that point.
At that point it was whatever. But in the process of seeing doctors to get the hamstring repaired, I wound up seeing 5 different surgeons, which was helpful. I tell athletes to get multiple opinions.
What happened at that one in Boulder? Like, to me, that was one of the most scary moments of my whole life so far.
One of the surgeons that we saw here in Boulder told me, quote unquote, he said the surgery was like trying to anchor a fish hook in hamburger meat, essentially saying that the process of trying to put the tendon, it ruptured tendon off tendon. So the process of trying to anchor the tendon back to the tendon, and it was possibly tendon back to muscle, which was where the confusion was coming from, was just so unknown. Yeah. They had never done it
before.
And
they were saying, like, you might not run again.
Yeah.
Ever.
And I was given that from 2 different surgeons, was told that I may not return to a high level competition ever again. And it was one of those, I think I just was in such disbelief and such processing of everything that it was almost just moving forward and getting more answers throughout that process.
Yeah. And then, you know, you were able to find another doctor, and like, what happened? So actually I'll always remember this. So I was waiting in the waiting room after, when she was getting her surgery, this big major surgery. And, you know, I'm a nervous wreck. Megan's much more composed than I am, as you probably tell, always already listening to the podcast. And he comes into the waiting room where it's just me. And I'm like sitting there, just a nervous wreck. And he just comes up, shakes my hand and said, "She's ready." And I just started bawling. And what'd you say to him when he came to you?
The first thing when I woke up, I don't even remember this. I just was clearly coming off of the anesthesia. I said, "Will I run fast again?" I looked him square in the eyes after surgery. The first thing I said.
After anesthesia.
And he looked at me and said, "Yes." And yeah. I do remember that moment. And it just, to me, it meant so much. Like, I'm almost even crying here thinking about that, knowing that, because his confidence gave me confidence and it was so key in my recovery.
And then a year later, you got to send him a text message of like slaying mountain trails and being confident in that hamstring. And it's just, It's crazy to think back to.
But I think one point on this, though, is that I think in that process, I learned the power of advocating for myself as a patient. So I got all of those different surgical opinions. I asked a lot of questions. I mean, we spent a week really diving into this, and that's not my nature. Usually I'm like, oh, hey, I'll go with this surgeon.
This is like the asking for help thing.
Exactly. Like, I wouldn't want to bother surgeons if I wasn't actually going to get surgery with them. And I just learned a lot about advocating for my body, advocating for myself, and speaking up.
Yeah. But before that, you tried to do everything right. You're a brilliant coach. And you still had the almost worst case scenario happen. Not quite, but it was almost there for an athlete. And like, that's so jarring, because this like abyss, we're all towing that line without realizing it all the time. And so there are some things you can do to prevent it, which we'll get into in a second. But the big lesson that we want to start with is like, it's okay to grieve about this stuff. It's okay to be sad. But not to let like fear of injury or fear of re-injury prevent you from living your life, especially as an athlete, because the whole point of an athletic life is to go for it.
Tangentially on this topic, we actually got a question and said, how did Megan tackle the mental aspect of a return to running after injury, and especially addressing the fear of re-injury?
From listener RW.
And that's a great way to build off of this conversation. So I would say my fear of re-injury was high during the entire comeback period. And I think I just got to the point where I expected that. Like, that's normal. It's okay. Yeah. I mean, me having fear of re-injury just means I care about running. It means I'm so passionate about the sport that I recognize that fear. The way I viewed it, though, is just, it was almost like training. It was like putting brick by brick into that training wall. Yeah. And it was like brick by brick of exposure therapy into that training wall. So just trying to layer, you know, good, decent run after decent run after decent run.
Like, so caring is beautiful. And like, I think it gets to anything. Like, if you really care about someone or something, like, you know, I am so scared of the time when Addie Dog, who's, you know, almost 8 years old, when she's going to die. But it's because I love her, you know, and the same goes for relationships. And when you're thinking about injury and running, like, it's having to reckon with these really hard, unpredictable, uncontrollable things. And so we all probably want to self-blame a little, but like,
well, it's like, where do those hard emotions come from? Yeah. But loving so deeply, like, if you didn't love so deeply, you wouldn't have those hard emotions. And I think I realized that coming back in my surgical process.
Yeah. It's like stepping into the arena with your own body. And, you know, when you step into the arena, sometimes you're going to lose.
Sometimes you're going to have a wild bull ride.
Yeah. Or get gored. Yeah. So, you know, that we want to say that, you know, injuries aren't fully inevitable. There are a few things you can do. The main one being, make sure you're eating enough always. Contextualize stress. You know, the body doesn't know miles, it knows stress. So try to make sure that you know, sleep and your lifestyle and stuff aren't just, you're not just chasing numbers. And, you know, listen to your body. Like, as soon as you feel something, rest is amazing. Nothing, 3 days of rest, you only get better. 3 weeks of rest, you'll be fine in a few days. So that courage is tough.
And cut yourself slack. I mean, we're all trying to do our best. No one wishes to get injured. And if you're dealing with fear upon return from an injury, just know that's normal too.
And talk about it, because every athlete is right there with you. Like, especially, you know, again, there's things that predispose people to it that are out of our control. But if you talk to athletes about it, we're all in that same boat. So you want to go to topic three?
Let's do it. I would like to add that we only have 4 minutes left, so we may be going to 2 topics.
Eventually we'll just be doing 1 topic probably. And that will be the ultimate in proving me wrong. So topic three, we're just going to do the first part of this question, and we've gotten a bunch of questions on like coaching and things around that world. So, the question is, when should normal people, which is in quotes, get a coach? What considerations are there? And the question goes on, talks about imposter syndrome and things like that. And this is from listener N. So I think, you know, starting from the place of what we're trying to do as coaches might help in athletes thinking about coaching themselves. Our goal is not necessarily to get our voice in an athlete's ear. What we want is to get the athlete's own voice in their ear saying the right things, the uplifting, joyous, loving things. So some of that is methodology, but most of that is just that unconditional support mechanism that a coach can bring in. So what is that voice saying, you know?
I think that voice is just telling you to keep going when times are rough. And I think the way that we coach is we check in with athletes every day. And I see that as one of the biggest things, is because we're just there to say, hey, this is normal. What you're going through is normal. What you're going through is shared by other people, and that it's okay to be dealing with these things. And, you know, just having that dialogue and having that support is great. And if you don't have a coach, like, you can find a proxy for that, like a partner, a friend, you know, someone who's there to lift you up when you need it.
For sure. And I think the methodology of it, like, you know, you're smart, you can figure that stuff out. So I would say, look at the self-talk in your own head. If that self-talk has work to do, then it might help to get an outside perspective. If you're pretty confident with that, then there's a chance you can do it on your own, you know? So we're obviously big proponents of coaches. It's what we do. You know, Megan coaches me and I coach Megan, but, you know, it's not necessary to have a coach if you can work there yourself. And so, you know, I thinking about like the uplifted nature of supporters, I was thinking about an example of the opposite of this, of like from an outside world. So in college, I made my first $100 ever in a race. It was a duathlon, so like running and biking, and I was so pumped.
For a duathlon, if there's biking in there, you should definitely get more than $100.
I know. Yeah, I mean,
dealing with the mechanical side of that, it should be at least $200.
You should have to pay people to do duathlons. And so one of my friends at the time, who's still a friend, said, oh, I think that amounts to like less than a cent per hour of work, right? You know, for all the training I'd been putting in since I quit football. And that stuck with me so much, because like, he was 100% right. And then you flash forward 15 years and this is my livelihood, you know? So yeah, it was only a cent per hour at the time, but like the long-term investment made it so that like, yeah, that time was worth it from a financial perspective too. And the reverse end of that, being lifted up by a supporter, is when coaching first started back in 2013, went to an accountant just for a consultation and named Lena, Lena's tax team in Sunnyvale, California. And she looked at this like little box of money, which was right around the same amount, like $100 or $500 or something like that. And she's like, this is what you should do, this thing, as opposed to the lawyer job where I was making more. She's like, this thing, this is clearly the thing you love. This is the thing that you carved out. And that's why you're coming to me. Do this thing. And, you know, if she wasn't around, like, who knows where this goes? So we all need supporters like that that lift us up.
I agree. I think the other thing on this, and we should make this a different topic at some point, is that coaching is a powerful thing itself. So I have personally learned more from coaching than I would say I've learned from medicine or science.
Wow.
And it's just the ability to communicate with people and to learn from them is something that is valuable for me. And I think it's valuable for a lot of people. And so I would love to spend some time on this podcast talking about like getting into coaching, what it means to coach, what we've learned from coaching. And I think that'd be a fun conversation.
Yeah. And you know, I think in the last 45 seconds, the idea here, like we find coaching so valuable, one, because we've gotten value in it from each other and then other people like Lena, but two, because there's this great power in lifting others up. Right. And so, you know, think about in your own life how you can be that person, even when, you know, you're not the official coach or whatever, how you can just elevate other people's voices, amplifying what they have to say, whether it's in at work, and then like telling them they're a boss and getting them to believe.
And I think that gets back to our earlier conversation too, about having the self-love and the, yeah, self-confidence to be able to do that.
Yeah, yeah. So you all are awesome. And, you know, go out there today and tell other people they are awesome too.
Thanks, everyone.
Woohoo! We love you guys.
Bye.